I really passionately believe that expectation management is one of the most underrated life skills. If you think about it, so much drama could be mitigated by just managing expectations better all around.
Hi, I'm Alex Fletcher.
And I'm Rivki Silver.
And this is Deep, Meaningful Conversations, powered by Town Appliance.
Alex and I wear a lot of hats.
We're both writers.
And speakers.
And so many other things, mothers, wives, friends, and active community members.
We love using our skill sets to bring you the best guests to share their wisdom, perspective, and advice on relevant topics.
And we love schmoozing about the topics that are on our mind, and hopefully yours too. Like one listener said, DMC is like hanging out with friends for coffee and talking about the stuff we're all thinking about.
So whatever you're doing while listening to our podcast, thanks for joining us for a DMC.
Welcome back to the podcast. We want to give a big thank you to Town Appliance for being our yearly sponsor of DMC. If you're in the market for any home appliance, Town Appliance is your go-to appliance store. They're completely different to typical big box stores because, thanks to their one-of-a-kind customer service with a firm shopper in mind, they sell you what you need, not just what you want. They listen to what it is that you're looking for, what your price points are, what features you're interested in, and they work with the customer so that she feels she purchased the perfect appliance meeting all her needs. Town Appliance showrooms are located in Lakewood, Cedarhurst, and Baltimore, but if you don't live at any of those places, you can just go to their website or give them a call. Check out our show notes for their website and contact information. Thank you, Town Appliance, for helping bring DMC to you, our listener.
Here's a scenario that you don't want to be in. Some Buckram are hiking in a beautiful but remote area. One of them falls and is seriously injured. He can't be moved. Ambulance transport is going to take too long, so he's going to need to be airlifted. But do you know how much that costs? And also, where are they going to take him? Like, where? What can they do? It's like I can't even imagine. Panic-inducing. When an emergency strikes, especially when away from home, simply knowing whom to call and where to turn is overwhelming. This is where today's episode sponsor, Hatsala Air, comes in. Hatsala Air is the global aviation department of Hatsala. It's been flying missions since September of 2019. It's a dedicated team of aviation, medical, and business leaders who, together with a handful of philanthropists, saw a need for urgent, emergent, and compassionate air transport that would complement and support the global network of Hatsala ambulance chapters. And now you can also help Hatsala Air through their Safer Tour campaign, Flights for Life. We'll tell you more about it later, and you know that the details are, as always, in our show notes.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Deep, Meaningful Conversations. We are so glad that you've taken the time for yourself to listen. Mm-hmm. Our last episode with Representative Dr. Dina Schmidman, we were talking about spiritual self-care. And I know for me, at least, listening to podcasts fits the bill. Even when I'm grabbing just even a few minutes at a time in the car, I'll take it.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't really underestimate the impact of listening, even for short segments at a time. It all adds up. And before you know it, you've finished an episode.
Agree. Although I don't really want to admit how many episodes of podcasts I have not finished. I don't know if it's just me. But sometimes I find like I need to be in the mood for the topic or even in the mood for the podcast or the podcaster. So I'll tend to do a bunch of jumping around. But I do think that listening to podcasts really is a valuable use of time.
Absolutely. Anyways, so today's episode is about wiring our children for happiness. Being happy is an aspiration that is thrown around easily. You know, everyone wants to be happy. We wonder if it's really even a goal in life. But happiness is crucial for healthy children and healthy humans. We're going to be talking all about it with our guest, Beth Perkel. Beth is an author, freelance writer, and essayist. Her recent book is called Light at the Beginning of the Tunnel, Wiring Our Children for Happiness. I love that title. Mm-hmm. She believes that most children need to be taught the quote-unquote talent of happiness. It doesn't happen automatically, although some kids do have a predisposition to being more cheery and some have the opposite. But it's the central key that enables them to live successful, productive, and meaningful lives. In her book, she synthesizes deep concepts from ancient wisdom, the most up-to-date psychological methods, scientific studies, and research, and then weaves them into a practical, personalized system for us and our children.
So Beth is very interesting. She actually published her first piece in national and international magazines by age 17. Mm. She won her first writing award at age 18, and she had her writing included in a New York Times best-selling book by age 19. And her education and passion for psychology and journalism began during her years at the University of Pennsylvania, where she graduated and conducted funded national and international research. Since then, she's written in-depth articles, stories, first-person essays for over a dozen online and print publications, and her work can be found in Newsweek magazine, the Chicago Tribune, Mishpacha magazine, Family First, Jewish Press. She has a whole long list, also in many books. She has essays. And Beth loves teaching, cooking Moroccan food, winning snowball fights. She lives in Chicago, where she gets to do that often with her husband and four children.
So if you listened to our podcast before, you know that Alex and I really appreciate a good episode about parenting. So if that's what brought you here, you're in good company and you're in for a treat. We hope you enjoyed this DMC with Beth Perkel.
Welcome, Beth, to DMC. We are so excited to have you on as our guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a thrill.
Okay, great. So we've got a lot to talk about. Let's, first of all, I would love to hear from you. You know, you're an accomplished writer. You're really willing to dig deep and talk about raw and personal topics in your writing. Is this something that comes naturally to you? Like, are you naturally this open, or is this a bravery that you feel like you've maybe developed over the years?
So it's an excellent question. It's definitely been an acquired taste. My writing career really started, I would say, in the first grade. I had an amazing, not to sound cliche, but I had an amazing first grade teacher that really changed my life. I used to turn in these 15-page stories to her, and she just said to me, "You are going to be a writer someday." And she saw the talent in me from literally grade one. And as a beautiful vignette, she actually came to my wedding. And wow. As part of the wedding present, she gave me a story that she had saved from all those years ago.
Oh my gosh.
To show, to concretize how much she believed in me. So that was my early humble beginnings. Then when I was about 17, my family had a subscription to Newsweek that I would, you know, sometimes read on Shabbos. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't really need a college degree to be a writer. So what would happen if I just submitted a personal essay to them? Like, worst that could happen is they don't take it. So that initial burst of confidence was a little bit less when I actually had the envelope in my hands and a friend of mine was driving me to school. And she said, finally at a stoplight, you have just between the red and the green light. So go mail it in that mailbox and get back in the car. I literally like threw it at the mailbox. I wasn't even sure it got in. And then a few weeks later, I came home from school before the days of cell phones. I'm going to date myself a little bit. And there was a note on my door my mother had written, like, Newsweek called, ?
What?
So that was my first essay. And it really sort of launched my confidence in terms of my writing ability. But as I'm sure you remember, as a 17-year-old girl, you have enough vulnerability in your regular life without putting it in your other material. So most of my writing at that point, I did Chicken Soup for the Soul stories. I got stories into books. I had I won my first writing award at 18. But it was really mostly stories about the vulnerability of others. It wasn't until many years into my career when although I was writing personal essays, I didn't get really deep and personal until I had a very very traumatic pregnancy where I was pregnant with triplets that dwindled to twins, and it was very, very dramatic with a lot of highs and lows. And eventually, when I thought things had finally calmed down, I lost the twins in my second trimester. Mm-hmm. And in that experience, a few days after, I remember there's a saying some people that are writers say, like, write for your life, you know, instead of run for your life, write for your life. Mm. And I felt like to process all the emotions and like the drama of the past few months, I wanted to put it into words. And I did a few days after I had the procedure to remove the babies. And that personal essay where I was so vulnerable ended up being, I think, my best personal essay I ever did, at least from the responses I got. I'd never gotten so much fan mail for any of my pieces. People were saying, you know, I put quotes on it next to my computer or on my fridge. Like, there was just a lot of chizuk in there for general difficulties people go through in life. And even like many years after now, people will still reach out to me and say, you know, when I went through my own loss many years later, I went back to that piece and it really helped me through it. So once I wrote that and saw how impactful it was, I realized like how much we need people willing to be vulnerable. especially mm-hmm. in our society where there's unfortunately so much fakeness, right? So especially with social media. So, you know, I there's been many pieces since then. I had another piece actually about the secret of my engagement ring, which not many people in the world knew was a cubic zirconia until I wrote this piece. Mm. and it was a piece about how when my husband and I, you know, were dating in a young couple, he was a Balchuva. And at that point, his parents were not so thrilled he was from. Baruch Hashem, they've come around. But they didn't want to pay for him to go to Israel. So he went to yeshiva with his own money. And when it came time for us to get engaged and pay for the ring, he was going to do it. But that would mean that we wouldn't have the money to go learn in Kollel. So we actually decided to buy a cubic zirconia and use the money to go to learn in Kollel. And that piece also, there was a lot of like wonderful feedback about, you know, sort of, you know, how to bridge this gap of materialism that sometimes our community goes down. And, you know, there's Kollel couples that reached out to me and said, you know, I really appreciated you, you know, you revealed this. So in general, I found it's an acquired taste to be vulnerable, but I found that my best work does come from that. So, you know, I've developed that over the years.
Where did you publish these two pieces?
They were
the pregnancy loss.
They were both in Mishpacha magazine, and they can be read on my website, BethPerkel.com. I post a lot of my work after it's published. So,
Wow. So family first.
Yeah, sorry, family first as part of the package.
Exactly. You remember the ring one was that was in a collection for maybe like Purim or something? Was that like in a? I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember which collection that was.
I think the secret of the ring. Yeah, I tied in my son's bar mitzvah to it. Yeah, I think it was. I think you're right. I think it was like after.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think because I think I had an essay in that collection too. I'll have to go back and check now.
There you go.
Yeah. Writing. And what I love like about, you know, we're all Mishpacha writers here. And what I really appreciate, like you were talking about the feedback, is there's such like a robust like community of letter writers, you know, and like you really do get feedback. Like when you write for this publication, like people really write in, and it's as writers, it's super valuable.
It's beautiful. There have been some incredible, there was this one story I wrote about, it was called Searching for Eliyahu, and it was about an incident where like my son, the whole story, we went on vacation, you know the first night of yeshiva week goes like you go to a restaurant, if you're lucky to get a table, you wait 2 hours for your food. So my little one, we'd ordered him soup because we thought that would come quick, which it did, and then he then proceeded to spill boiling hot soup on himself. And there was this very big, suddenly the whole restaurant galvanized and like everybody had their opinion on what to do. But one man sort of stepped through the crowd and coordinated care, got my son to the hospital. It was this whole situation.
Oh, wow, it was that bad. And very hot soup.
the piece, well, Baruch Hashem, in the end, there's an incredible tip everyone should know. Sliced potatoes absorb the heat of a burn, which I didn't know. So I called the piece Searching for Eliyahu because the rest of the trip, everywhere we went, my son was like the celebrity, but we never seemed to find Eliyahu, the guy who had like stepped through the crowd. So anyways, in the piece, I do eventually find him, but and it's a very funny story. But when I wrote the piece, like Motzei Shabbos after it came out, we got this call, ironically, right after we said Havdalah and we're singing about Eliyahu. He actually tracked us down and called us on the phone. So
amazing.
It's so funny how when you write for a big magazine like this in the Jewish world, you know, you really are connected to so many people.
Yes,
absolutely. Well, you've recently written a book. Now, that's very different than writing essays. You recently wrote a book on parenting. I'm so curious, like what led you to tackle this topic in book form? And what made this particular, you know, there's a lot of books on parenting. So what is unique about this particular approach about the book that you wrote?
So it really weaves in three passions of mine. So going back a bit in my story, so I went to the college at the University of Pennsylvania. And to date myself again a little bit, this is before positive psychology was even a thing. So the man who's considered the father of positive psychology is a professor called Martin. His name is Martin Seligman, and he was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And he wrote the first book on positive psychology called Authentic Happiness when I was a freshman. So back then, I was in this program called University Scholars. It was sort of like the honors program there. And part of the program was they gave us opportunities to do research with these big professors, and they even funded our research to go places. That's an excellent story also on how I used that to go to Israel on a free trip and to do a study there. What was so interesting was, even though I didn't do research with him specifically and I chose a different professor, I followed the progress of his work and positive psychology through when I graduated and when we went to Bein Kollel in Israel. And I always was very fascinated by the concepts and topic. And I feel like it really fits a lot with Judaism and a lot of the concepts there. So that was really, really where I developed that first passion. The second passion, you know, we went to Israel, I started having kids, and then it's like trial by fire. Like, you learn on the job, you know, all the different things that work in parenting and don't. So that was always a second fascination of mine, as I think it's for all of us as we go through that wonderful process in our lives. And then the third piece was, when we did come back to America, my husband became a Rav Avishol and I was a Rebbetzin. And I would give shirim in the community where I weaved in these positive psychology concepts. And I found it was received very well. And I decided to start a blog. So at first it was a blog called Light at the Beginning of the Tunnel. And it was on the Times of Israel website. And each week I would present a piece of positive psychology weaved in with the support of Torah. And this eventually was the seeds that became the book. I expanded it to become the full book, Light at the Beginning of the Tunnel, Wiring Our Children for Happiness. And in terms of what makes it unique, I'm gonna specify a few things that I think really set it apart. The first one is that I split the book up into four major sections. And in the first one, I try to really get at the heart of exploring who your child is specifically. I feel it's really important, although there are many books on happiness and parenting, they're very general. So here, I'll ask the two of you. What's the last appliance both of you bought?
Oh, like for like our appliances? Like for our dishwasher?
Now we need to plug town appliance.
It could be
appliance.
Anything that you felt you had to pick out the instructions.
They come with the thing, and then I put them on the shelf where I ignore them. That's what.
So if you were someone who wanted to know all the features, right? Which would you go on? Let's say it was an Instant Pot. I'm going to put that in your Amazon cart retroactively, okay? It was just Prime Day. Let's say you bought an Instant Pot. Would you go online and just search up how to use an Instant Pot in general? Or would you want to take out that specific instruction manual for your make and model?
I mean, if I'm going to be completely honest, I probably would just go online because I would forget that I had the book. But it does make more sense to use the actual book that comes with the device.
Oh, my setup didn't work perfectly there, but in theory,
sorry.
If you were one to say, ideally, I'd want to know the make and model, it would streamline the process, right? Like, certain things are obvious, yes. Like pressing it on, but like, you know, there's certain things like, you know, there's like all kinds of pressure in an Instapot and things you want to know how to do specifically. You would ideally want the manual for your make and model. So that's what I really do in the first section of the book. I try to help parents understand their children as individuals. I'll give you an example. So I have this unique concept called pilot light motivations. And it's a concept I've developed where you can explore what is it exactly that is leading to most of your children's behavior. So we know that a person is faced with literally tens of thousands of decisions a day. That's what research tells us. And so one might say that who we are is really our decisions that lead to actions. Therefore, understanding the decision process of ourselves or our children can help us understand their behavior much better. So what a pilot light motivation is it's sort of like these motivations that are always simmering below the surface in our consciousness, that when faced with a decision, like just like a pilot light on a stove, when it's ignited by fire, then, you know, all of a sudden it creates this fire. So too, when we're faced with a decision, our pilot light motivations kick in. So when we're able to, with ourselves or our children, take a step back and try to look at the antecedents to their behavior, what are the motivations leading to them, we can help ourselves help them in a better way. I'll give a practical example, so this isn't so theoretical. And in the book, I always try to be practical. That's very important. Let's say that there's a child or a group of four children, and they have an assignment from school where they're going to have to present tomorrow, do a presentation on a talent they have, okay? Four children, all in the same class, same assignment. Those four children the next day, let's say they all have not done the assignment, okay? So it's all the same result, the same choice, same decision. But let's go behind the scenes to the four children. Person one, or child A, one of his pilot light motivations is laziness, okay? He's just, he doesn't like doing a lot of work. So he gets home, he thinks about the assignment, but he's really just not in the mood. He had a long day of school. It just doesn't end up happening. Not malicious, but it just doesn't get to it. Child number two, or we'll call him child B, let's say she, one of her pilot light motivations is self-consciousness. Okay, so for her, she filters things through like this self-consciousness where she gets the assignment and she thinks to herself, I really don't want to present in front of the class. Like, I don't want to get up there. So in the end, she doesn't do the assignment either, but it's for a completely different motivation. Let's say child C, their pilot motivation is anger, right? They get very triggered by things and they're either upset at their teacher that day, or maybe they came home and they're upset at their parents. So like, it is more of a rebellion type decision, okay? And let's say child D, she's just a pleasure seeker. You know, one of her pilot light motivations is pleasure seeking. So she just wants to like do whatever's fun. So it's not that she like is trying to be malicious either, but she just gets distracted at home by reading or doing art or whatever she likes to do. And it just doesn't end up happening. So if we relate to the end product, all four kids had the exact same decision, but we can see now that all of them, what led them to that was completely different motivations. So we can help them better when we help them figure this out. So that's an example of one of the exercises in the first section. And one of the things that makes the book unique, which is trying to help you figure out the make and model of your child. Mm. The second piece I would say is that I really focus in the book on happiness as an entire family endeavor. So have you guys ever heard the saying, you're only as happy as your least happy child?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So I would say the same is true too. For children, a lot of times they're only as happy as their least happy parent. So how we feel and how we react, our children are sponges. They can understand even at a young age much more than we think. They're very intuitive. So that paired with the fact that modeling is really the sharpest tool in our parenting toolbox means that as parents, we really need to work on our own happiness too, in order to be able to model to our children. So as I mentioned, the book is split into four sections. So the third and fourth section is really about parents' happiness. The fourth section is their toolbox, creating the tools to support themselves in this endeavor, both externally and internally, right? And the third section is about building their own happiness. So I think that also makes the book very unique, as we're not just looking at it as this one-way street between parents and children, but getting to the heart of getting the whole family happier.
It's fascinating.
I love that.
So talking about happiness, like what parent doesn't want their children to be happy? Like we all want our children to be happy, but it just sort of sounds like this like catch-all phrase in a sense. And I'm really curious to you, like what does that even mean? And what does happiness look like in a child?
So that is the million-dollar question of any happiness book. And I'm so glad that you asked it. Because the truth is, and again, I'm trying to be very specialized, but it really fits with this especially, happiness looks different for different people. And therefore, happiness looks different for different children. And I'll give you a specific example from the book. I have this chart in the first section where one axis, the x-axis, is about activation levels, right? Deactivated versus activated. So what does this mean? Everyone has sort of different activation levels that are their baseline, right? Some people are very energized and some people are more mellow, right? The next axis is pleasantness versus unpleasantness. So how do different people on that gradient, right? What does it look like in them when they encounter something negative versus positive? So let's start with the negative, because that's something I think people know about more, right? Like if someone is a more, let's say someone encounters something bad in their life, right? If you're a very activated person, that might lead you to be angry, right? We know that anger is a very active emotion. Another thing is anxiety. Anxiety is also a state of activation, right? Think of someone like tapping their foot or like their mind is racing. Like it's a very activated emotion. Versus someone who encounters something bad and is a more deactivated person, they're going to become maybe more likely to be depressed or have low energy and fatigue. So the same unpleasantness manifested, like they look differently, although they're both upset, right? So too with happiness. That's the less known side of this equation. someone who's, let's say, very activated, for them, happiness might look like they're excited, they're elated, they're very energized, versus someone who's like more deactivated, for them, it's just a feeling of contentment or maybe calm. So depending on your child, it could look very different in them. You know, there could be the happy clappy type, and there could also be the more just like contented. So that's the first piece, I would say. The second thing I would say, though, if we were to give it a definition now, right, and try to make a catch-all definition for you to your answer, I would say happiness in a child is being well-adjusted. And I talk about that a ton in the book. The second section, which I haven't touched on yet, is about, and that's why it's called Wiring Our Children for Happiness. Each chapter is a skill that we want to wire into our children. Okay? I know that sounds the imagery is a little shocking, but we're literally trying to like set their initial factory settings when we're their parents, right? So we're trying to wire in these different skills. So a lot of them have to do with being well adjusted. So emotional agility is one of them. Grit is another one. How to deal with adversity is another section. And the way, I guess the image I'd give for it is, I talk about it like the shock absorbers on a car, right? What are the shock absorbers on our car when we're going down the road? Especially if you live in Chicago, where I live, there are a lot of potholes. So you're like clunking down the road. And the shock absorbers on the car, they help it be a smooth ride. Even when you encounter those bumps, it's still smooth. So what we need to do is we need to build up in our children these shock absorbers. So even when they don't always get what they want or they have difficulties, they can have the ability to adjust. So happiness in children is really giving them the skills to be well adjusted. And some of that also involves a lot of mindset work, which we do a lot in the book. This is a little funny anecdote. I have these flags that follow throughout the book. The flags say mindset malfunction. So when you come to those pieces, I'm flagging to you like mindset malfunctions that you can work on with your children. And my husband, who's a little bit of a jokester, he took a picture of one of these flags. And whenever he thinks I'm stuck in a mindset malfunction, he'll just text me the flags. Just a little example of what you write can and will be used against you.
Oh my gosh.
That's really
funny. Because you are the expert. You got to like completely internalize all this, live by it, you know? Oh my gosh.
So that's what I would say in terms of that aspect.
I love the idea of rewiring our children and ourselves also, because I think like you said, like this is a process that we're all learning together. Like we're all learning this together. And as we learn how to model, so then like we're teaching our kids how to not have mindset malfunctions, but we ourselves also, like, I mean, we like, who can't relate to having an adult temper tantrum? We don't call it a temper tantrum because that's embarrassing. But like, you know, sometimes we also, I you know, it can be possible.
Hypothetically, absolutely.
Not hypothetically. It's like, you know what? So then we have to learn how to do that ourselves. Can we calm ourselves down before telling our kids to calm down? And so like all of these tips that we have that we can use to kind of like reset those neural pathways to get better outcomes and to raise our happiness all around. I love it.
100%. Because essentially, you know, going back to how I said we create our children's initial factory settings, our initial factory settings were created by the homes we grew up in, right? And sometimes we have to do a little reparenting of ourselves. So we view the entire world through whatever mindsets we became comfortable for us. So I'll give you a great example, something I talk about in the book. Okay, I'm going to give both of you ladies a little scenario. So you go to the grocery store, you see a friend of yours you haven't seen in a while, and you are so excited to see her. You give her a big hello, and she gives you kind of like a lukewarm wave, you know, kind of whatever. And she's like, you just rushes on to, you know, rushes.
Mm-hmm. We've all been there. Right? Okay, I'm sure we've done that to other people too.
And exactly. Sure. So I want you to tell me what would be going through your minds after that, both of you individually. What would be your reaction?
Okay, like my immediate reaction is like, what did I do wrong?
Okay.
Like, what have I done?
Okay.
Why doesn't she like me?
Right, like, are we really friends? Like, you know, that was kind of a little bit parve that, you know, that hello she gave me. Okay.
Right, like, have I been misreading our entire relationship?
Exactly.
Do I think we're closer than she thinks we're closer? Like, do you know, like, that mislevel of, like, the closeness of the relationship?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So just in that small example, you know, next to while you're, you know, sorting through the blemished bananas, like, just with that, all of a sudden, like all these preconceived mindsets get activated. So there might be one person that says, what did I do? Like, I thought we were friends. There might be another person that says, like, does anyone like me? Like, they might take it to a next level. Like, they feel so
hurt. Right, catastrophize it.
And then another person might say, oh, wow, she must be really busy. Like, you know, I should check on her later. Something must be going on, you know? So it's so important to, like, recognize when things are activated in us and to try to get to the deeper meaning of why, even for adults. So I 100% agree with you on that.
Amazing. Okay, many years ago, I worked in customer service. I think everyone should have to work in customer service at least once in their life. It's very informative. It left a very lasting impression on me about the importance of how to treat a customer, as well as plenty of lessons about how not to be a bad customer, I want to say. But that's one thing that I really appreciate about Town Appliance is that they really care about their customers. When you buy from Town Appliance, you're not just another number in the statistics of some big corporation, some big box store. You matter. Your needs matter. Your price point matters. They want to make you happy. They're not like, oh, I'm getting through another day of work. They care. I'm still thinking about that email we got a few months back from the customer who got a bracha from her Town Appliance salesperson.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
So that is the kind of shopping experience that I am looking for. And, of course, they offer all brands, all models, and for all budgets. Give them a call and see how they can help you find the appliance you really need. Check out our show notes for more information.
Let's tell you a little bit more about Hatzalah Air. So before Hatzalah Air launched, the only options available to patients in need of medical air transport were either to find a generous philanthropist with an available aircraft.
Do you have that person's phone in your...
Nope. Or to turn to for-profit private air ambulance operators who charge fees that are outside the reach of many patients. Those are not great options. Hatzalah Air services are always provided free of charge, and Chabad centers, now in 100 countries worldwide, medical referral organizations, local Hatzalah divisions on an international level, and institutions, organizations, and community leaders worldwide now have a dedicated resource to turn to. And right now, Hatzalah Air is giving us a chance to help support this important and expensive service through their Flight for Life Safer Torah campaign. When you purchase a letter, which is only $18, you are literally writing health and protection for those who need it most. You could buy a letter for each of your children or for everyone in your family or for the cholim that you regularly daven for. The link is in our show notes.
Okay, so you've talked about these four different sections and just all the wonderful things that are contained in your book. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your... It's not even fair to ask about a favorite chapter. Like, we ask these favorite questions. It's not even fair because it's like, how can you pick a favorite? But we're going to make you pick. What is your favorite chapter in the book?
I love that question. I have a few. And the reason... I'm going to tell you two. They're from two different sections of the book. The reason I find them to be my favorite is because I think they're really unique. The first one is I have a whole chapter on expectation management. I really passionately believe that expectation management is one of the most underrated life skills. If you think about it, so much drama could be mitigated by just managing expectations better all around. So, and that's just talking even with adult interactions, right? Like how many times with our spouse, like we expect them to intuit something with us, or like even as simple as like, well, I thought you were throwing out the garbage, right? Like chores, like we just were more forward and metacognitive about our expectations. So much drama could be avoided. With children, and I talk about this, you know, with children, there's so much, there's so many aspects of things where we just assume our children get it, right? They got the memo. So we'll tell them something very general, like, I need you to behave in this situation, right? Like, let's say we're at Kiddush, right? A wonderful free-for-all, right? If we say to them, I need you to behave at Kiddush, that's way too general. Okay, like saying to them what your expectations are of them for behaving is much more effective. Saying you can take one treat or however many treats you allow versus stacking the plate high. We're not going to run around in the kiddish room. And if you need to speak to me and I'm speaking to an adult, just put your arm around on my hands and I'll turn to you in a minute, right? Just then, by like communicating those three things or whatever it is that behaving in kiddish means to you, all of a sudden the child has a way for you to actually discuss with them after whether or not they behaved. It's been made tangible, right? Same thing with classic one is, let's say they're eating dinner at the table and you say, don't be such a slob. you might be assuming they know what a slob is, but they're thinking, sitting there thinking, yeah, I'm just eating my dinner, right? So like saying to them your expectations of what not being a slob means to you is so much more effective. So saying like, I expect you to put your dishes away after you're done, depending on the age, of course. Like if you've made a mess under your seat, please take a broom and like put back whatever condiments you've taken out, right? And then already you've expressed to them what your expectations are for them in terms of not being a slob. And I just find in so many different situations in life, and especially parenting, if we're just more specific about our expectations to our children, things can be so much better. We literally, I know this is going to make us sound like drill sergeants, but we gave our children these expectation lists for like Erev Shabbos and Shabbos that improved Erev Shabbos and Shabbos so much. Like Erev Shabbos was like a mess of, you know, everyone, I don't want to take a shower. I want to take, I want to do this, you know? And once we made these lists, like they saw exactly, everyone was on the same page, like down to the fact where we said, like, if you want a Shabbos play date, like tell us by Friday morning. That way, like 10 minutes before Shabbos, there wasn't the kid that was like, are you gonna make me a play date? What am I gonna do all Shabbos? You know, like, here's the expectation. If you want to have a friend over, tell us who and, you know, what you want. And then we'll do that. Because also, how many times have one of us like made a play date for someone and then they come home and tell us they already made one at school? So you want to all be on the same page, right? To avoid those awkward situations. So I love that chapter because I feel like it's such an underrated life skill that can help so many situations. The second favorite chapter of mine is in the Happiness for Parents section of the book, the third section. And it talks about self-care. And the reason I really felt so passionate about this chapter is that I feel like self-care is another one of those buzzwords that has sort of like become a catch-all that's not very helpful. What self-care is meant to be, right, at its core, and how you can evaluate whether your self-care is actual self-care, is asking yourself, after I do this, let's say it's a manicure or whatever it is you think is self-care or you're doing as your self-care, do you go back into your regular life then, recharged and happy to be back in your regular life? Or are you just returning to like a life that you're unhappy with to begin with? If it's the former, then that's great. You've recharged. If it's the latter, then real self-care would be doing whatever you need to do to make a life that you're happy with day to day than the opposite, which is escapism, right? Like going to get a manicure, but like hating your life, that's not going to help. So like a practical example is if you save up all this money to go on a vacation, a 1 week beautiful vacation, but then every day you're dreading like going back to your regular life, maybe you should evaluate taking those $2,000 and doing whatever you need to do in your day-to-day life to make that a happier place, right? Like maybe you want to go on a date night with your husband. You can use that money to pay for the babysitter and go on a date night. You know, maybe you need more cleaning help. But I love that chapter really addresses how we can better recharge ourselves and have better self-care.
It's a great litmus test. Yeah, because sometimes I do wonder, like, vacation, like, what is this really? Is this just an escape from reality? Like, is this, or is it actually helpful? But I think that that's a great, you know, litmus test to see how you're feeling afterwards.
Yeah, I love that it's like that. I love that you made that identification of, like, self-care versus escapism. Mm-hmm. I think that that's very clever. I haven't heard it expressed that way before.
Agree.
Right.
Okay, so let's keep going. Tell us your advice for parents with a child or children who are not happy.
Okay. Yes, the troubleshooting is always a very important of any approach. So I'm very glad that you asked that. I have so many answers for that, but I'm going to try to streamline them. The first thing I'd say is that we as parents, we need to build our children up as much as we can at home. I once went to a Rebbetzin's conference and there was it's a class actually on helping girls with body confidence, but I think that this first slide could apply to this entire concept of building your children up. The first slide was a picture of a baby in a bucket, you know, one of those weird things we do where we put babies in buckets and take pictures. But this particular bucket had these holes. These holes were punched in it and there was water streaming out of the bucket. And the person started the presentation with saying, we need to fill our children's buckets so much that when the rest of the world drains them, they still have enough water to stay afloat. And it the image mm-hmm. always stayed with me because it's so important. We all know that we cannot control the outside world. You know, we cannot control what goes on in school. If they have a nice chevra, don't have a nice chevra. If they're, you know, the other things that are happening. But what we can control is only our own behavior and how much we build them up. So, I mean, one of my middle children, I once, she was in a stage of very much being a middle child. And I used to have this time at bedtime when I'd say to her, literally like this, this is the time of day where I tell you something great about you. And every day aww. I would tell her something great about her. That's and I awesome. Wanted her to go to bed thinking about that, right? I couldn't predict what was going to happen the next day with her, but I wanted her to go to bed being built up by this, you know, this thing that her mother had told her. The next troubleshooting piece I think is really important, and I have a whole chapter about this in my book, is the concept of helping our children with having a timeline perspective, right? Like, when children are young, I mean, you ladies remember being 15, right? When you were 15, you thought that like, oh man, you'd been on Earth for so long, right? Like 15 years, that took forever.
Right.
But then the next 15 years went by and you're like, oh, well, that was much shorter than the first, right? Like time just starts going by so quickly. So for kids who don't have a lot of time under their belts, they don't have this way of like looking at things and understanding like you're not going to necessarily feel that way forever. Right? You think you're going to be, that's always going to be a problem or you're always going to be upset, but it's just not true. Like we can help them with our own timeline perspectives and helping widen their scope that things can get better and they're not always going to be stuck in whatever particular situation they are right now. And, you know, life evolves and situations are in flux. Like you might be in school with these people now, but you're not going to necessarily be later. And, you know, there's all these different pieces to it. You have to be very real with your children when it comes to this. Like I tell them stories from my own life where this can help them. Like I have a daughter who's just graduated eighth grade and going into high school, and she is not looking forward to it. And it was a very hard decision, you know, about picking the school and all that. And like, I would take her, you know, to these interviews or these, you know, and I would say to her, I totally remember being where you're at. You know, I had a really rough start to high school and like I've talked to her about it. And then I say, you know, that's so far in my rearview mirror, you know, like and these stories are able to help them borrow from your own timeline, I guess, you know, and widening their scope for their own perspective.
I love that borrow from your own timeline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another piece, because again, I think there's so many pieces to this. I think we all have this, you know, every family that's a big family, like some kids are just more hardwired to be negative, right? Mm-hmm. Or they can get in a rut, even the ones that aren't so negative. So like the best way to help them sort of get out of that is to try to like slowly, gently, like drag out of them the positive things too. You know, like I have one kid right now who loves coming home and telling me like all the negative parts of their day. And I say, I'm so happy to hear, and I'm fine with hearing those, but I need you to also tell me one positive. And usually they can find one positive, and that's already like a very big win, right? In sort of getting mm-hmm. them out of that negative rut. The last thing I'd say, and this sort of connects to the first one, is we need to show our children that we're there for them, okay? Especially when our kids are unhappy, like they need to know that we are creating a relationship where they can always talk to us. And I know that sounds like cliche, like, oh, of course I know I need to like be there for my children, but I'm going to make it a little more tangible. I think a common thing that we do that we don't always realize we're doing is like our child will come try to talk to us. There's like no context that they realize we're in the middle of something, right? When they want to speak to us, right? And what will we say to them? What will you guys say to them?
Like, wait, like not right now?
Huh?
Wait a minute.
1 minute, right?
Wait a minute, yeah.
Yeah, like, well, give me a minute. Give me 5 minutes. I'll be there. Well, we'll talk. And what happens? Like, we're busy. We forget, right? We're like, okay, yeah. But they've noticed that 5 minutes have gone by and we haven't come to talk to them, right? They notice that we've sort of forgotten it. So, like, the best thing to do is to literally never do the 1 minute because it's not going to happen.
And they're keeping track also.
Sorry.
They're keeping track on their clock.
Oh, yeah, totally.
What time it is.
They got, like, the internal, you know, the turtle mommy stopwatch going on. But it's better to like literally make a time, like make a date with them. Like, I really want to talk to you, but let's go in the den after dinner and we'll talk. Or it's a really busy night, but this is important to me. So I'm going to meet you at bedtime. We'll talk for like 10 minutes at bedtime. And it's just, it's both the showing them it's important, but also making sure we actually do it. So much of parenting mm-hmm. is making sure we come through for our children. I just read this story a couple days ago. The famous psychologist who was a Holocaust survivor, Viktor Frankl. There's a lot of like famous quotes from Man's Search for Meaning, but I never heard this story before. There's a story where a woman, a suicidal woman, called him in the night and told him that she wanted to take her life. And he spent the entire night on the phone with her, giving her all the reasons why she should stay in this world. Wow. And he saw, and she said, okay, I'm not going to do it. And he saw her on the street a few days later or something like that. And he said to her, so New, which was the reason? What was it that convinced you? And she said, none of them. There wasn't one reason. It was just the fact there was someone who was willing to stay up with me all night and cared so much that I stay here. And I, you know, obviously that's an extreme case, you know, and, you know, Bezras Hashem, none of us are ever dealing with that with our children. But it's the message from the story that, like, often people forget the actual words that were said to them, but the experience they remember, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you say something bad, they'll remember that forever. But but the important thing is that they want to know you're there for them. So try to take off your problem-solving hat, right? And just listen and be there as much as you can.
Ah, so true.
Amazing. Well, Beth, you've shared a couple of the stories of personal anecdotes of parenting wins that you've had in your own family using your approach. Like, I really, really love the fact that you gave your daughter something that you love about, like something great about her, like every yes. night. I love that. I'm going to borrow that business. Lean at her. But can you share a few other stories of parenting wins you've had in your own family using this approach that you have?
Sure, I would love to. Depending on time, I'll share a few. So the first one that I really think was one of those very in the moment situations where you had to, you know, figure something out. During the COVID lockdown, when we were all shocked by the fact our kids were going to be home with us 24/7. And at least in Chicago, with the schools my children were in, they had very little content during that time at first while they sort of regrouped. So what would happen? My children would gravitate towards electronics. And I think one of the biggest challenges facing children in this generation in general is time management, right? There's so many distractions all the time. And like, we know even as adults, we can't have a complete thought without our phone pinging, right? So with our children too, they get very distracted by things and they're not, part of that leads to them not being very good with time management. So I decided I wanted to use this time to like teach my children at least some nuggets of time management. So what I did is I made these file cards for each of them. They were color coded depending on the kid. And each card had like one, I gave them each five cards. I think it was five cards. And each card had something redeeming on it that I wanted them to do that day. Okay, so they could choose. So I'll give you an example. Let's say with my oldest son, he was in seventh grade at the time. So one card was that he had to exercise. He could choose how he wanted to exercise. It was like maybe 20 minutes of exercise. He could go shoot hoops in the yard. He could go run around our property. He could go use the treadmill inside. Something to just move his body and get exercise. That's an important part of something you should do every day. The second card was to have a social interaction, right? He had to reach out to a friend and call or whatever it was. That was the second card. The third card was to follow a fascination. I think that it's so important to, you know, get our children to have redeeming hobbies, right? Like I think when we were younger, we had more hobbies than sometimes I think this generation does. So we talked to him about what he might be interested in. He wanted to learn money management. You know, that's a typical seventh grade boy, like interested in money. So we found these videos from the library that he could learn about money management tips. So he would watch one of those every day. The fourth one was, I had a three-year-old. This was a little bit Machiavellian of me, a little bit self-serving. He had to spend a half hour a day giving his littlest brother enrichment. So they each had their shift with the three-year-old. And that was like giving back to the family. And then the fifth one was doing a chore. They all had their chore of like, you know, contributing to the household. So each of them had, based on their own, you know, age level and group, but these were like the general things. And they could do them as quickly as they wanted or like spread them out over the course of the day, but no one could touch an electronic till they did their five cards. And it really taught them this both time management and redeeming their time. Now, of course, you know, there's the funny stories where like you figure out they're like getting around it. Like one of my daughters, she would do like a Zumba video for her exercise time. But I realized she was listening to it at like three times the speed. Doing like speed Zumba, you know. But that anyways, that I consider like a big parenting win. And I talk about time management in the book. Another one actually just happened. So it's a really fresh story to mention. I also love talking about with children. We need to teach them in life. There are really multiple planes of winning. Like it's a very competitive society we live in. And although there's like on one side, we have everyone gets a participation trophy. Like on the other side, people like really do realize like, you know, sports, whatever, like there is a winner, there is a loser, right? But beyond that, there's so many other planes of winning in life that we need to bring out to our children. So I'm going to give a great example to drive this home in from my own family. So my fifth grader in her school has this competition in fifth grade called Battle of the Books. They have to read 25 books over the course of the school year. And then they have this like game show like competition at the end of the year where they're put into teams. And all year long, they work with their team. They divide up the books, they know whatever it is. And then they have this game show like competition. So, unfortunately, my daughter's team was not great. Two of them didn't want to read any of the books. I think another one of them was reading some of them. And like, she is a big reader and she really wanted to win. So she read these books like multiple times. She got a little like too caught up in the competition. When the actual competition came, she came home. It was a multi-day competition. The first few days she came home, like, we're doing well, you know, I'm carrying the team, like, it's going well. And then the last day she came home crying. And I said, what happened? And she said, you know what happened? I was this close to getting second place. The reason it was a multi-day competition because they had to just each have their slot with the different teams. So she said it was the middle of one of the game shows or whatever. And I noticed that the moderator, the way she asked the question to the other team was misleading, and I knew they were going to get it wrong. So I corrected her, and because of that, they got it right. And that one point made me like lose. Like she didn't get first, second, or third. Her team ended up in fourth. And I said to her, I said, are you kidding me? You won. You won the Yashrus Award. You won the honesty. Like, you know how Hashem is celebrating for you? Like, I know you didn't get this plastic trophy, but Hashem is celebrating for you. And then later that day, even better, I get a text from one of her friend's mothers. And she said, you know, I have to tell you, I know how much that competition meant to Huvi. And my daughter came home saying, like, Huvi is my best friend. Like, she was so happy for me that I won. And, like, I couldn't believe, like, how happy she was for me, even though, you know, even though she wasn't one of the winners. And I, like, they didn't know my daughter was at home crying, you know? And I said to her, like, you won the Friendship Award, you know? Like, there's so many planes of winning that are more important in life than, like, the trophy or the recognition. And, like, when we help our children understand this, I think it also is so much like of a contributor to widening their scope and improving their happiness. So,
And what I think is so important about those two examples that you chose to share is the first one is like very conscious and conscientious parenting. Like I actually am a teacher, but that sounds very teachery, like color coded cards and blah, 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 blah. I have no inclination to do any of that kind of parenting. Like for me, that's like very overwhelming. You know what I mean? And like someone could listen to that and be like, wow, that's like, that takes a lot of effort. And that's amazing. It's kudos to you that you did that with your children. But the second example was literally all about your response to something. It's like how you responded to your child. That doesn't take as much planning effort, but it's being conscientious to think, how can I build up my child just from how I'm going to respond? What words are going to come out of my mouth based on something that happened during the school day?
Right, right. And I'll tell you, I have a bit of what you said with you and the first thing too. It actually, like, I'm not good at those like sticker charts. That takes too much like daily effort. What I loved about the cards in this situation was I made them once and then it was up to them to turn them in before they got an electronic. So it was really plug and play after the initial effort of making the cards. So
and they listened to you too.
They were like, electronics. But yes. It did serve its purpose of wiring them with some time management skills. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, but I do very much believe in plug and play. Like maybe do pick things where you have to do the effort once, but then you don't have to keep like putting the star on the chart or whatever, you know? because I'm not good at that either.
Okay, Beth, so tell us, what's your next project? And are you doing anything now?
Yes.
Different. You just wrote a book.
Yes. Well, yes. I have actually. Okay, so now that we're so deep into the deep, meaningful conversation over here, I know I've referenced a few things that, revealed my age. I'm actually going to just go for it. So I recently had a big birthday. I turned 40 this year.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And that actually led to two projects. So the first one I had, it was just like in my mind. Have you guys ever heard that saying, like a woman needs to reinvent herself every decade? Have you ever heard that saying?
I have.
Yeah.
So
I've also heard 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Just put on the pressure.
That's too much reinvention.
Right. I like the 10 years because, like, if you think about it, like, our 20s, I don't know how old you ladies are. You look very young.
We're older than you.
Yes. We have already had that milestone birthday.
Got it.
We are on the other side.
So fine. So you remember, like, the 20s are exhausting, ladies, right? Like, you're pursuing everything in your 20s. Like, you're looking for a husband. You want to buy a house. You want to start a career. Like, 20s are exhausting, you know? And then the 30s are not that less exhausting either, because a lot of those things you're still pursuing. You're still building your career. A lot of people are still having more children. But, to me, 40 felt like a little different. Like, my youngest is now 7, and it really felt like sort of going into a different era. And I was thinking about, is there any way I want to reinvent myself? And one thing is with my writing. I've always been very passionate about fiction, but I haven't done much fiction. So I've started doing fiction. I've started writing some fiction for the magazines. I actually wrote my first novel manuscript. And so it's actually a mainstream dystopian youth adventure novel. And so I'm going through the arduous and toughening up project of looking for an agent, which is not fun.
Is this book for a general audience?
Yes, it's for a general audience.
Wow.
So finding an agent, I can't tell you how many people have told me the J.K. Rowling story. Don't worry, she submitted to like 200 agents. So I might not be J.K. Rowling. I say that right up front, but it's still an inspiring story. So my fiction is part of my project. And the second piece, which has to do with my 40th birthday, is that I did this kind of soul searching for my 40th birthday, this internal project where I thought, like, how cool would it be to, like, look back and think about, like, the 40 biggest lessons I've learned in life upon turning 40? And at first I was like, am I really going to come up with 40? And then I came up with so many more. And I sort of had to, like, narrow it down to, like, the 40 most impactful things I'd learned from my 40 spins around the sun. And I actually, at my birthday party, I shared it with my group of friends. I shared the 40 lessons. And I found that it led to such fascinating conversations that I really felt like I wanted to sort of like bring the concept to a broader audience. So believe it or not, I actually started my own podcast, which is called Ideas That Change Lives. And it's centered around this concept. And each episode of Ideas That Change Lives, I present either like one of those 40 lessons from my own life, or I talk to my guests about like what are the most impactful lessons you've learned in your life. So essentially it's like a treasure hunt where all the gravel has been sifted for you and what's left is the treasure. So my listeners,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, my listeners get chizuk, about their own well-being and happiness. They learn from other people's mistakes. So so that's been a really fun project, like a passion project that I've really enjoyed.
I love passion projects like in your 40s. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and you're a real hustler. I'm really impressed.
Thank you. It's good to get that chizuk, something.
Yeah.
Telling me the time of day you're telling me something good about me.
Like when I write a book, like I'm done. Like I'm done. I've done everything I came to accomplish on this world. I don't think I'd be thinking about doing something else.
The antecedents to the book, it's funny. I had to, for Light at the Beginning of the Tunnel, the last version, like the last draft I had to send to my publisher was due like during that Corona lockdown. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to finish this. And every, because all my kids were home with me, so every day, like, my husband would spend the work hours in our office in the attic, and then he'd come down, we'd have dinner, then I'd go up till midnight and work. So it was this crazy situation. I couldn't wait till the book was done, and I finally turned it in one night at, like, midnight, like, midway through the lockdown, and I had the sense of relief, And then a few days later, I was like, I missed it. I missed the creative outlet. Mm-hmm. Like, I love writing. Mm-hmm. And it was just, especially at that point where I needed a creative outlet, it was so good for me. So that's when I started writing the fiction novel. And it was really
Makes sense, yeah.
It really helped me get
there. I would love to do that. When I was little, by the way, Beth, it really resonated what you were saying, because I also had a teacher in sixth grade who I would send a notebook of my short stories to. She would write in the margins. I actually wrote about that in Mishpacha once, too. It was exactly the same experience, where she would use these words like, you are a writer. And she was wiring me, like, literally, it just built up my identity and my self-confidence just from her. I think that really brings this interview full circle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it shows how much a teacher can impact a student for the rest of their lives.
Indeed. Well, no pressure, all of our teacher listeners. Mm-hmm. We always ask our guests if they have any book or speaker recommendations for our listeners who want to explore more about this topic. So lay it on us, Beth. Like, do you have any book or speaker recommendations that people can go and learn more of? Besides, obviously, your book, who else can they benefit from?
Right. So, of course, I was going to mention my book, Light at the Beginning of the Tunnel, Wiring Your Children for Happiness. If you do decide to buy it, please buy it on Feldheim or Mosaica, because Amazon is very predatory. Algorithms. So
good to know. We will put that link on the show notes.
Yes. Okay, amazing.
Yeah.
So in terms, I'm going to split it into a few different recommendations. For parenting, it's really the classics that personally I recommend, like Revolba's Planting and Building is an amazing, amazing book that I think every parent should read. I think also in terms of speakers, I personally have learned a lot from the Rebbetzin-Spentner approach. I know she's like a parenting guru in Israel, but there are also talmidim of hers in America that teach her approach. So if you can hop one of those courses, sometimes she even does like a mini course. She did one in Chicago this year. It was like intensive for 3 days. So she's excellent. In terms of like positive psychology, I'm going to mention two books that I think, again, my approach is like the whole family happiness. So these are two, like, one's a very famous book, but I don't know how many people know about it in the firm world. The other one is a lesser known book that I really enjoyed. It's called, I have to remember the whole title. It's called Stress Less, Stop Stressing, Start Living. And it has really practical mindfulness activities that I thought were really clever and really easy to incorporate. So that's one. The other one is The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. It really is like a mindfulness powerhouse. That book I found like incredibly enlightening in terms of really getting to the heart of mindfulness. And lastly, in terms of speakers, obviously everything that we do in our modeling, everything's going to filter into like when you're a firm woman, like avodas hamidos, like just improving your midos, improving like everything you can do. So I am like a big chassid of Rebbetzin Schoonmaker. I love her.
Is that Dina Schoonmaker?
Yes. She has a website, Women's Vod, where she has a lot of her recordings from different like midos that she works on. Each one I've done has been like life changing. So I definitely recommend her. And then as a general thing, I would love to say is, in terms of reading or interacting with any of these things, obviously different things speak to different people. But I'm gonna share with you guys something that changed the way I absorb shirim and books, whatever, mostly books. I now no longer read just like STEM. I almost always read, whether it's a novel, whether it's a nonfiction book, with a stack of those sticky flags next to me, because what I found was, how many times do we like read something or hear something, we're like, whoa, oh my gosh, that was like life-changing, and like a week later, like, you know, our mind was blown a week before, and now our mind's put back together. We've forgotten the whole thing, right? So like,
her mind was put back together. I love that, after being blown. So true.
So it bothered me. I was like, oh, I wish I remembered. I don't want to read the whole book again and have to find all those pieces. So what I started doing is I read everything with those flags. I put the flags in. At the end of the book, I have a few files on my computer where I transfer those quotes. Sometimes I even do with my kids. I have them read me the quotes and I type them. So then I'm like discussing the material with them and also, you know, copying it over in a more efficient way. And then it becomes like a cliff notes of inspiration for you, of the things that resonated with you specifically, right? Like, everyone has different things that resonate with them. But this way, like, the things that really impacted you can go back to them whenever you need chizuk and just like look at the document. So whatever you choose to read, I recommend you consider reading in that way.
Wow. Well, you're the first guest that actually has given us a tip like that. I really, that's great fabulous.
Advice. It's fantastic advice. I've done that when I'm like preparing for like a, like to give a talk or something, but I've never done it just for like my own actual benefit in my life. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Cause then you feel like you're going to remember, you're going to remember what inspired you and it can inspire you over again, you know? And I've used so much of that material also in my podcast, which when I started the file, I didn't know I was going to start this Ideas That Change Life podcast, but it became such a help because I had all these amazing quotes from different books that like bolstered what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, you had tons of content just right there already. It's fantastic. Oh my gosh, Beth, this has been such a fantastic and far-reaching DMC beyond even just the topic that we like ostensibly brought you on for, but I've learned so much about so many things, mm-hmm. not just parenting, but also my own life, my own happiness. And I'm sure that our listeners are also reaping the benefits of your breadth and depth of inspiration, but practical and relatable and accessible tips. So I just want to thank you so, so, so much for coming and having this DMC with us and continued hatzlacha in all of your many endeavors.
Amen. Thank you so much to you guys as well. Keep inspiring the masses. And thank you so much for hosting me.
Okay. Beth, wow. Okay. So I feel like she's very practical.
Yeah.
And I also appreciate about her is like she clearly has a real love for psychology and a love for writing, and this book combines both. Something I like about her book is that, and I remember Ruchi Koval talks about this in our parenting episode with her, like so often we're just focused on like parenting the kids, but we just neglect, quote unquote, attending to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I really like that her book focuses both on a parent and a child. Her definition of happiness, being well adjusted, that children have the ability to adjust, that emotional agility, grit, dealing with adversity. I think that was very insightful. I also like what Beth was saying about a key component to happiness is expectation management.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that really resonated, and that we need to be better at communicating our expectations.
Yeah.
That was a big one.
Oh, man. Yeah. I was actually just thinking recently about how I definitely could work on that, the communication of expectations.
Oh, all these things I could work on.
Absolutely. It is a lifelong avoda. I liked when she was talking about getting to the pilot light. Motivations of like what is really motivating our child. Our child is not doing the thing that we want them to do, but why?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the motivating factor? And I really liked that curiosity to like explore what is going on there instead of just being frustrated, but to be curious and to try to see what tools do our children need in order to be able to better function.
Right. It reminds me a bit about like the love languages. Like everyone has their own love language and each person has their own pilot light motivation. So it's our job to like discover what it is for each child.
Yeah.
And then we can help guide them once we understand like, oh, this makes sense for this kid. This is their automatic.
Exactly. And the idea that we view the world through our mindsets that we're comfortable with, like we've gotten into these, certainly at this point in adulthood, like we have our default settings of like, what are our mindsets? Are we more negative? Are we more positive? Like where is it holding? And we can still rewire ourselves to have a optimum, I'm not going to say perfect because I'm working on that perfectionism always, but like to have the best possible mindset, really, to make sure that we're viewing the world through the mindset that's going to lead to greater happiness, and then we can give it over to our children, you know?
Hmm.
And then the other thing that really struck me was the multiple planes of winning. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like when she was telling that story about her daughter, I was thinking about actually one of my children was doing this competition that our school has had, the fun run, where they would all run around and race with people in their age group. And then, you know, people would win a race. It's a running race. And one of my sons, one year, his yarmulke fell off in the middle of the race. This is a very fast kid. He regularly would be like the winner in his age group. He's very fast. His yarmulke fell off and he stopped to get his yarmulke and then he didn't win.
Oh, sweet thing.
Right? We told him, like, you won with Hashem. Like, you know, it's like, it's okay. And he did come to be like proud of that was his, that was his impulse.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. So
very interesting.
Anyways, but yeah, and this is something that I can tell myself also, like of multiple planes of winning. Like if we don't win the quote unquote obvious prize, but what are we learning? Like what are we still gaining? How are we maybe winning in a different way that's not necessarily immediately obvious?
Here's this episode's takeaway. Happiness looks different in each human being. Some of us respond in an activated manner and others in a deactivated way. Try to be more conscious of how you display happiness and then notice how it looks in your loved ones around you. We are so grateful that Town Appliance has partnered with us to promote this podcast. Town Appliance is really the go-to appliance store, serving thousands of customers since 1979. It's a whole generation growing up with Town Appliance. You can check out their gorgeous showrooms in Lakewood, Cedarhurst, and Baltimore, but if you live out of town, you can check out their gorgeous website. It's so easy to navigate, plus it has helpful tips like where is the lint filter on your washing machine? How often should you change it? And more to the point, how on earth do you change it? Whether you're walking into a showroom or ordering over the phone, you'll get the same individualized customer service they're known for. Check out our show notes for all their contact information. And when you're in the market for your next appliance, think Town Appliance, the obvious choice.
Before we go, let me share with you another amazing Hotel Air, another amazing service that Hotel Air provides. So they have a bank of miles to use for domestic flights. You might think, like, well, what does it have to do with airlifting, right? But over the years, hundreds of families have been gifted travel on commercial flights. Just think about it. A patient is in a hospital far from home, and family members need to visit. Like, the patient is at the place where they're getting the best service. Either they couldn't be in a different place, or this is like a specialized hospital, but it's far from home. But like, they need to be either have a family member with them or be visited. It's complicated. It's not simple. Through generous donors who gift their miles, as well as relationships Hatsala Air has formed with organizations, airlines, discounted award travel, and special handling, Hatsala Air often makes the impossible possible. They can make it possible for you to be there at, not you, a person to be there at their loved one's bedside in the hospital far away. And you can become part of the ground crew for Hatsala Air with your donation to the Flights for Life campaign. Every patient deserves a hero that can fly. Check out our show notes for your opportunity to support this incredible organization. Next episode, we are actually doing a special rebroadcast. It's so exciting. We're actually at a point where we can do a rebroadcast of an old episode. Like, this is a milestone. It's one of our favorite episodes from back a little while ago. So it is our DMC with Professor Leslie Gutman about developing resilience. If you didn't hear it the first time, here is your chance to check it out. And if you did hear it, this DMC is definitely worth listening to again.
If you haven't already, please subscribe and follow our podcast on whatever platform you're listening to this episode now, and rate and review. You can also share the love and send a link to a family member or friend who you think would benefit from our podcast. See you next episode.